This is 4:55 on Friday, August 26th.
But at the same time, it's a little late.
Good morning. So, here we are. So, I want to point out a couple things. Please do log into Clix. We're going to do some questions today, so you'll need to keep that open. Second thing is there's an assignment now posted in the assignments column, and you should begin to address that. It is due. Whoa, wait a second. So it's not posted. It will be as soon as I get back to my office. I put it on the staging area of the website, but not on the actual website. So I will take care of that. But it will be right here, chapter 1 assigned. And it's due next Friday. And you'll upload it using the same mechanism that you used for the info assignment. And by then, hopefully, I will have all of the additional people added to the list so you can turn it in under your own name. Next thing is, has anybody checked out the audio or video files? So here's the thing that people don't always understand about this. The video files include the audio, right? So you're not supposed to have to open the audio and the video and make them match up. But sometimes the audio in the video files does not work on particular players, and so people will get this impression. So if the audio is not working in the video file, then we need to figure out why that's not happening, rather than try to sync up the audio file. All right? So just let me know if that's a problem, and we'll see if we can figure out why that's happening. Any questions about logistics or anything we talked about last time, or comments? So what we're going to do today is we'll continue building up some of these internet concepts that we did last time, and then we'll take a look at the slides for chapter one. So last time we talked about the telegraph and sort of how that was an antecedent to the internet work, and also how the problems that arose in telegraphy are sort of common and carry forward into the internet as well. This time we're going to start with the telephone. And so let's draw a picture of the telephone. That's called a microphone. That's called a headset or speaker or whatever. And that's the idea of the telephone, right? And so when you talk into the microphone, it's a variable resistance device. So the current that goes through the circuit depends on the sound pressure of the way talking on the microphone. It makes the current vary in the circuit. You attach that to essentially a magnet and a drum at the other end, and it vibrates and reproduces sound waves. Okay? Simple enough. Took 40 years after the invention of the telegraph to get to the point where Alexander Graham Bell produced his prototype of the telephone. And this, of course, became very popular beginning in the 1880s or so, and we did telephony for the next 100 years, roughly, before we started switching back to digital techniques, even for telephony, and that's another story for another time. So what are the issues that and solutions that we have in the telephony world that carry forward from telegraphy? Well, there's still the problem of how do you go long distances, right? And adding voltage, but can we add repeaters to the telephone system? Does that really make sense? Remember, remember our first technique in telegraphs was add repeaters. Can we add repeaters to telephones? Not very practically, really, because what would a repeater be? It would be another microphone sitting next to the speaker. There's a better way, and the better way got invented about 20 years after the telephone itself, and that was the idea of an amplifier, an electronic amplifier, where we could actually take the electronic signal itself and make it stronger. And so it's kind of a repeater, but it's not a repeater in the sense of the telegraph repeater that just had another telegraph key that was doing something. The other thing that for going long distances that we had in telegraphs that doesn't really work very well for telephones, at least that provide something that we would call telephone service, is the idea of store and forward, right? You don't carry on a conversation with your grandmother over the telephone by speaking to an operator somewhere in the middle who then relays your message to your grandmother after having heard the whole thing. You know, your grandmother probably wouldn't understand that very well. Of course, there are sort of translation services like telephones for the deaf, where people will sort of convert conversation to typing. But in general use, store and forward is not what we expect to have for telephony. So given that, the idea of circuit switching, and we saw last time the telephone switchboards, became... Gosh. Why? Why?
Why not?
It's crazy. It's just... circuit switching, right? So, the idea is that, and it's sort of somewhere in between here, there's a giant multi-position switch that connects this wire to whichever customer. And it's a lot more complicated, of course. But anyway, so circuit switching became the predominant paradigm for communications with telephones. Sort of beginning in the 1890s and carrying forward to, like I said, the 1980s, 1990s, about 100 years, that circuit switching was the predominant thing that was done for communication. And out in this realm of telephony, of course, grew up the gigantic monopolies, AT&T, the American Telephone and Telegraph Corporation, General Telephone. These telephone companies had typically monopolies on telephone communication within a service area. And the service areas were huge at the time. I mean, you guys are all way too young to remember when AT&T was the company that covered almost all of the United States except for a few places like Pullman. Pullman actually did not have AT&T. It had General Telephone. And the only thing that was you were allowed to do with the telephone company's networks was plug in telephone company equipment. You had to rent your telephone from the telephone company and plug it into the telephone network. And the reason was because they had designed their electronics essentially so that its telephone instruments had to meet very specific specifications
in order to be safely attached and not disrupt the network. Well, along about late 1960s, a couple of things started happening. First of all, people started saying, well, you know, this is a communication network, and maybe I can send bits over this network. And what did we use to do send bits over this network at that time? No, modems. The idea of modems came about. Modem is a word that means modulator or demodulator, right? And so what they were doing was they were imposing different frequencies to mean one and zero on the telephone wire, and then on the other end you could demodulate that and get back the ones and zeros. And we started out with, what did we start out with? 110 bits per second. 110 bits per second. That, when I was a student at WSU, we had teletype writers that used modems that communicated 110 bits per second. That was how fast you could go. And a couple of few years later, you could go 300 bits per second. And then maybe a little bit later, you know, I don't remember all the steps. Eventually, the next step I remember is 9600 bits per second. And then 28.8, 53 kilobits per second, sort of all evolved from, say, the late 1960s until the mid-1990s. And then we started getting other technologies. We'll talk about that. Anyway, but the telephone network was circuit switching, so what happened when you had one of these modems was that you had the ability, essentially, to say, send bits from one place to another place, because it was circuit switched. And then somewhere along the way, people realized, well, that other place that I'm talking to might be a more networking sort of place, and that led to the idea of internet service providers who had huge banks of modems, and you would call up a number and your modem would connect to one of their modems, and off you would go. So on, so forth. But the main point of this exercise is that circuit switching became dominant. And circuit switching now feels very alien to us because we're used to the world of packet switching. So how did it change? How did we start to move away from circuit switching? Well, in also the 1960s, the U.S. Department of Defense was in the middle of what was known as the Cold War, and most of you are all too young to remember the Cold War. But what was the issue in the Cold War? What? That was the adversary. What was the great fear? Nuclear warfare, right? The Cold War was about not having a nuclear war. And so the Department of Defense was horribly worried about the following problem. Suppose I use circuit switching to establish connections between those two points. Well, if I'm going to have a circuit, I'm going to follow one side or the other of that, right? I should draw that middle thing. There isn't really a middle thing. Right. The dashed line is what I want to communicate, and the dark lines are the actual links. So the fear is that somebody comes along and explodes nuclear weapons and those go away and now I can no longer talk to my adversary. I'm ahead of myself. Back up. Circuit switching and point-to-point occasion. The Department of Defense, with all its bases and command posts and everywhere, is very wealthy and has had at the time sort of point-to-point links attaching everything. Okay, no circuit switching or packet switching. Now the fear is that if that gets taken out, point A and point C can no longer talk to each other. It's the bad thing in a war. So the Department of Defense, through its research agency, commissioned a bunch of study that ultimately led to the idea of what we now know as packet switching. The idea that sort of regardless of what happens in the network, if there's any path at all between A and C, it will get used. And it will get used on an instant-by-instant basis and not require me to sort of make telephone calls to find ways through the network. All right? So that was the genesis of this idea of packet switching, is that it goes back to how to have a robust network in the face of links that come and go. And we appreciate that these days, but we've also made much better links than we had before. So the other word that I've been using here is packet switching, which is taking messages and breaking them up into little pieces that have to be put back together to recover the whole message. And we're going to talk a lot about that over the course of the semester. So, questions about this? Observations? It's not just a technical field, right? It's also a commercial field. It's a field where economics matter. We hear huge amounts of arguments between telephone companies, cellular providers, cable companies, content suppliers about who should pay for what and what are the things that lead to the incentives to keep making it better. There are no easy answers about that. But keep your eye open for in the business news about who's arguing with what about, with whom about what. There's just continuous argument about how this should be regulated or not regulated. in the modern day, it affects you as consumers as to what you can get over the network. What sort of service you can get over the network? Should Netflix have to pay more to the internet backbone companies because they supply a lot of data to go over the networks, or should you as consumers pay more? Should the fact that you as a consumer pays more for your internet connection somehow be structured to lead to the investment that makes the backbone better? On and on and on this goes, and like I said, there are no clear answers. Right.
So was it the Department of Defense that set up most of the internet cables?
Did the Department of Defense set up most of the internet cables? No. The Department of Defense in the late 1970s through the 1980s built something called ARPANET, which was really the first widespread packet switching network. It connected Department of Defense facilities and a few universities and research laboratories. And proved very, very attractive to those research laboratories and universities, to the point that they said, we should make this more available. So beginning in the late 19, 1980s or maybe 1990, there became something known as the NSFNet, the National Science Foundation Network, that connected primarily universities and research laboratories now on a much bigger scale to allow them to communicate data about the research they were doing. And out of that came things like widespread email. The World Wide Web was invented sort of in conjunction with that era. The idea that you could go places and see files directly on your screen as opposed to just retrieving them into other files and looking at them later. So NSFNet came with restrictions that said you shall not use it for commerce. Okay. Because it was funded by the government. Suddenly the light went on and people started to say, oh, well, we can start to use this for commerce. And in its very last couple of years, they started relaxing that restriction about no use for commerce. And that then led to the beginnings of commerce. And once people saw that, then the existing telephone companies largely started to build the backbone links that we now know as the internet. So it really was built privately, but it was built on a whole lot of research that was done both by the Department of Defense and by the National Science Foundation. So I think that the public has a lot of claim to being able to use the internet in publicly valuable ways based on the fact that the public invested all this research in it. It isn't merely that the internet service provider companies have spent on the internet, the public has too.
Okay. Questions? Comments? We all rely on it, right? We all rely on the internet. We rely on it not only for our commerce, we rely on it for education, we rely on it for our email communications, text messaging, all kinds of things have been invented, and to a certain extent we rely on it even for telephony. And circuit switching in telephony is all but gone, right? There's even if you have what is known as an old-fashioned telephone line from the telephone company, yes, that last link to your telephone is an analog system, just like I drew there. But once it gets to the central office of it, once it gets to the other end of that wire, it's all digital and packetized. And of course, many of us have switched to digital versions of telephony, even at our endpoints. Our cell phones are all digital telephony. If you have your telephone service through the cable company, you have digital telephone service. Yeah. All right. So let's now. Don't need the women from the telephone company. Let's now take a look. Wow, fancy. All right. So the authors of the computer networking top-down approach network have provided sets of slides that go with each of the chapters. I've put those up. They may be helpful in getting through the reading of the chapters, but you should be reading the chapters as well. There's a lot of stuff that is in the chapters that is not here. So We've done a lot of what's in these slides already in our little exercise of inventing the internet, but there are a few things that we want to touch on. So the internet is a number of things, and there are a number of different perspectives that you can take on it. One is the stuff that makes up the internet, and the stuff that makes up the internet is, of course, our computers and our telephones as so-called edge devices, and a bunch of stuff in the middle that is the core of the internet, and then the stuff that connects all that, whether it's radio transmitters and receivers or wires or fiber optic cables. That's one sort of view of what makes up the internet. Another view of what makes up the internet is the standards and protocols that all those things use to talk to each other. And these have been absolutely as essential to the success of the internet as the fact that we're able to build all that electronics and lay all that wire. The reason that we can successfully get web pages from China or Israel or Russia or the United States is because everybody has agreed to follow certain rules. Those rules are called the protocols. The rules are called the protocols. The process of getting everybody to agree on the rules is standardization. You know about HTTP, the protocol that's used for retrieving web pages, HTTPS for securely retrieving web pages. We're going to talk about protocols like TCP, the Transmission Control Protocol, UDP, the User Datagram Protocol, IP, the Internet Protocol, which is sort of at the foundation of all of this. And the point of those protocols, of the great invention of the Internet, is that they designed the protocols in such a way that they could work with any of this stuff, right? That they were broadly applicable. It didn't matter whether you were using radio to connect your devices, or fiber optics, or telephone-based modems, even, or DSL, or you know, or whatever. The design of the protocols was such that they were broadly applicable. And so nowadays, suppose I want to invent a new device. Right, a new device for communication. What do I do? I say, how do I make it compatible with the internet? The internet doesn't have to become compatible with me. I have to become compatible with the internet. And this was a complete revolution from the time of communications as it existed in the 1980s, even data communications in the 1980s, to what we have now in the form of the internet, is that somehow it became universal, and that was why the internet is what it is. Another way of looking at the internet. So we've got two so far, right? The stuff, the protocols. The third way is, what are the services that are available on the internet? And of course, we've talked about web and email, voice. Service, etc. And then there are a whole bunch of services that run in the internet that make the internet possible itself. So if you've heard of something called DNS, the Domain Name Service, that's a service that's associated with the internet, and the reason it's there is to make the internet work better. It doesn't have a great reason for existence apart from making the internet. It's not independent. It's part of making. Questions? So what are protocols? Protocols are sets of rules about what messages are sent, what they contain,
what order they're sent in, what the responses to certain messages should be. So in this class, we have protocols, for example, about how to behave in class. So what's a protocol in this class? Yeah, there's one. Okay, right? I asked for a response, and somebody puts up their hand, or you put up your hand, and then if multiple people put up their hand, I pick one person, and he talks, and maybe somebody else puts up their hand, and they talk. So that's one protocol for classroom behavior. Another one is, suppose I have you divide up into groups and do brainstorming. That's a different protocol, right? You no longer have to raise your hand. You can have a conversation in your group. It gets noisy in the room. I wait for it to die down a bit, and then I say, okay, it's over, and then maybe I call on the groups. Okay? So protocols sort of govern a lot of things in daily life. The word itself arises, it seems to arise from diplomacy, actually, the time of kings and ambassadors, and the rules by which ambassadors interact with other governments are all built around protocol. There's actually an office in Washington, D.C. called the Office of the Chief of Protocol, and the Chief of Protocol is responsible for making sure that when the ambassador visits the Secretary of State, that the Secretary of State is not offensive to the ambassador, unless the Secretary of State intends to be offensive to the ambassador, because being offensive is part of protocol as well, right? certain times, by being offensive, you communicate certain messages that you wouldn't otherwise. Okay, so protocol in networking is about format, order, and meaning of messages and how you respond to them. Okay, we did that. All right. I don't want to go through all of this in detail. We've talked about how you attach to things. This is a point that we'll be coming back to in future lectures. How fast can you send data? Bandwidth measured in bits per second. Electrical engineers probably don't measure bandwidth in bits per second, rather in sort of frequency cutoffs and so forth. But we loosely use that term here. Talking about networking. Another issue is whether this available bandwidth is dedicated to a single user or whether it has to be shared, because if it has to be shared, what did we see last time? If a resource has to be shared, we have to design a protocol for sharing, right? there has to be some way that people can figure out who is allowed to use a resource at a particular time. So we have protocols for that. DSL, you read about this in the book, but I don't. We'll talk more about Ethernet. We'll talk about wireless. Okay.
Now we get to
the mathematics of networking, and this is mathematics algebra. Will do you. I don't think we need to talk about one thing, which we get to. So how do we measure networks? Measure networks and measure network performance. We said that we're going to take our messages and divide them into packets, and every packet, therefore, has a certain length, and we'll talk about the length of a packet in bits. And we'll talk about the links between pieces of the network as having certain bandwidth measured in bits per second. And therefore, when I want to send a packet over a link, how long does it take? It takes the length of the packet divided by the rate of the network, bits per second, which gives me an answer in seconds. Right? So unit analysis is going to be your friend in doing these sorts of exercises. And these are the kinds of exercises that are in that first assignment that you'll be doing. And we call that time that it takes to send a message, that is to just pump it onto the wire, is called the transmission time. And it's length in bits divided by the rate in bits per second, and it gives me an answer in seconds. Okay, so having put a packet onto a link, how long does it take before it gets to the other end? Well, that's what's known as the propagation time. Right? Because we know that although light travels very fast, it doesn't travel at infinite speed. And so, therefore, it takes a certain amount of time for a packet that's transmitted at one location to reach the other location. That amount of time is called propagation time. And how does it get calculated? Well, where'd it go? I don't seem to have a formula for that. Let's just talk about it. How would you figure out how long it takes for a packet to put in one end of a link to reach the other? What would you have to know? Yes? Do I need to know where? Do I need to know the location? I need to know the distance. How long it takes depends on the distance between the two, right? But not exactly where they are. So I can pick them up and move them anywhere as long as they're the same distance. Right, so I need to know the distance. What else do I need to know? The speed, the so-called propagation speed. So we talk about the propagation delay, which is measured in seconds, and we talk about propagation speed, which is measured in meters per second, okay? Or miles per second, or as one of my colleagues likes to say, furlongs per quarter. Whatever. It's a distance over a interval, right? Is a
propagation speed. Okay, so now let's turn to a few clicks questions and see what we can do with those. So this is just to get your numerical processing processes in your brain going on the appropriate kinds of problems that we're talking about. So here's our first one. So why is it showing me that? Interesting. Weirdness. It doesn't want to give back my screen. This is a new one on me. once I did that, it decided I now have two screens, which means that I probably can go there.
You can set it to mirror it.
Yes, that's what I want it to do. There we go. Okay. New laptops, new behaviors. All right. So, think about this. 20 milliseconds. You've been working on this, right? So, yes. 20. It occurs every 20 milliseconds, then how many times... Why doesn't it show that? Does it occur each second? 50 times, right? Because 1,000 milliseconds per second divided by 20 milliseconds is 50. Good. So we often talk about network data rates in terms of millions, thousands, or billions of bits per second, namely megabits, kilobits, and gigabits. Now, one thing that I want you to sort of absorb about this is that in networking, we usually associate these prefixes with their decimal form. So M is really million, 10 to the 6. It's not 2 to the 20. Kilo is 10 to the third, not 2 to the 10th. And giga is 10 to the 9th. Okay? If you don't absorb this fact, you go off and you do your homework, you're going to be working with inconvenient numbers. I give you convenient numbers for when you do the decimal version. So, and that's what we usually do. Anyway, network speed is 10 megabits per second. How long does it take to send 1,000 bits? I'm asking you about a transmission time. And I guess if it were a megabit per second network, it would take a millisecond. So this is a 10 megabit per second network, so it takes a tenth of a millisecond. So that's answer E, but it's also what? It's also 100 microseconds. Those two things are the same.
Get used to going back and forth. They're both valid ways of saying this.
Okay, so yes, all right, let's go through this. Micro is 10 to the minus 6th. Milli is 10 to the minus 3rd. Nano is 10 to the minus 9th. Okay, so get those in your brain.
Okay. We sort of need those three on the sub 1 level, and we need kilo, mega, and giga on the bigger than one side. Beyond that, so this is sort of interesting. One of the things that people observe about computing is it's a field where we often have to deal with scales simultaneously, with scales that range from 10 to the minus 9 or even 10 to the minus 12 all the way up to 10 to the 12th or 10 to the 15th when we're talking about petabytes and exabytes and so forth. So a huge range of numbers that you have to be willing to work with at different times. Next. Signal propagation speed. Remember, propagation speed is in a distance per unit time. Usually expressed in terms of meters per second or kilometers per second. What is the speed of light in a vacuum? Physics 202 question.
Yeah.
goodness. I can see that physics 202 did not sink in strongly in this crowd.
It's 300,000 kilometers per second, not meters. Okay,
186,000 miles per second. That when I was growing up, we still did things in miles, so I remember miles. But and I also remember a T-shirt from the 1970s with a picture of Einstein on it that says 186,000 miles per second. It's the law. These things help me remember things like this. And for me, since 186,000 miles per second is the main thing I remember, and I remember that kilometers are a little bit shorter than miles, then I can easily remember that 300,000 kilometers and not meters. Anyway, little tricks. Okay. In wires or optical fibers, signals travel slower than in a vacuum, and we often use 200,000 kilometers per second as a rough estimate. So that ranges, right, from 0.6 or so up to 0.75 or so, but always slower than the speed in the vacuum. Using 200,000 kilometers per second as a rough estimate, how long does it take a signal to travel in a wire or a fiber optic cable across the U.S. about 5,000 kilometers? Five divided by 200 seconds.
Right.
So what is 5 divided by 200 seconds?
0.05 seconds.
No, I don't think so.
1/40th of a second.
1/40th of a second, which is how many milliseconds?
1/40 is 0.02.
0.025. What? 0.025, which is how many milliseconds? 25. There we go. Okay, so go back to that. So the point is not just that you can do something, but also that you understand how the arithmetic relates to the problem. We did that one. Next.
Does it depend on the
I can see that physics 202 has not sunk in well with this crap.
Well, I remember that problem where, like, they shine light through air and then goes for glass, and there's like a different ends for
there are. This is asking you about a guided medium compared with free space, a vacuum. Right. It's certainly different in different media, but it's always less than in free space, right? You can't go faster than the speed of light in this space. Okay. Right. Okay. Well, those are the questions for today. I would appreciate. Don't put your things away. Sorry. I would very much appreciate if you would if you would give me a click over in this space to sort of give me a clue as to how this is going. And I will tell you what your colleagues think before we finish. Just one click per person, please. Otherwise, it's sort of hard to interpret. Okay, so it looks like about 55 or 60% of people think this is new. About 40% think this is review, but useful, and about 5% think it is boring. Okay? So that's what we did, how we did today. Okay? See you Monday.
Yeah. I'm going to go across the street.